Part 3. Visions of Treachery. Chapter 11. Amid the empty reaches of space, a pinprick of light shone like a jewel upon a pall of velvet, a mournful glow lost in the wilderness it travelled through. It was a ship, though not a ship that would be recognised by any but the most diligent remembrancer who had scoured the depths of the Emperor's Librarium Sanctus on Terra for references to the lost Eldar civilization. The mighty ship was a craft world, and it possessed a grace that human shipwrights could only dream of. Its colossal length was fashioned from a substance that resembled yellowed bone, and its form was more akin to something that had grown rather than been built. Gem-like domes reflected the weak starlight, and an inner radiance glistened like phosphorus through their semi-transparent surfaces. Graceful minarets rose in scattered ivory clusters, their tapered tops shining gold and silver, and wide spires of bone swept from the vessel's flanks where a fleet of elegant ships like ancient sea galleons was docked. Vast conglomerations of wondrously designed habitations clung to the surface of the mighty craft world, and a host of twinkling lights described beautiful traceries through the cities. A great sail of gold and black soared above the mighty vessel's body, rippling in the stellar wind as it plied its lonely course. The craft world travelled alone, its stately progress through the stars like the last peregrination of an elderly thespian before his final curtain. Lost in the vastness of space, the craft world floated in utter isolation. No starshine illuminated its sleek towers, and distant from the warmth of sun or planet, its domes stared into the darkness of empty space. Few outside of those who lived long and melancholy lives aboard the graceful space city could know that it was home to the few survivors of planets abandoned eons ago amidst terrifying destruction. Upon this craft world dwelled the Eldar, a race all but extinct, the last remnants of a people that had once ruled the galaxy, and whose mere dreams had overturned worlds and quenched suns. The interior of the greatest dome upon the craft world's surface shimmered with a pallid glow, its translucency enclosing a multitude of crystal trees that stood beneath the light of long-dead stars. Smooth pathways wove through the glittering forest, their courses unknown to even those who trod them. A silent song echoed through the dome, unheard and invisible, but achingly yearned for upon its absence. The ghosts of ages past and ages yet to come filled the dome, for it was a place of death and, perversely, a place of immortality. A lonely figure sat cross-legged in the centre of the forest, a spot of darkness amongst the glowing crystal trees. Eldrad Ulthran, far-seer of craft-world Ulthway, smiled wistfully as the songs of long-dead seers filled his heart with joy and sadness in equal measure. His smooth features were long and angular, his bright eyes narrow and oval. Dark hair swept over his tapered, graceful ears, gathered at the nape of his neck in a long scalp lock. He wore a long, cream-coloured cloak and a tunic of flowing black cloth, gathered at the waist by a golden belt studded with gems and fashioned with complex runes. Eldrad's right hand rested on the trunk of a crystal tree, its structure veined with darting lights, the suggestion of peaceful faces swimming in its depths. His other hand held a long seer staff, of the same material as the ship, its gem-encrusted surface redolent with dangerous power. The visions were coming again, stronger than before, and his dreams were troubled with their meaning. Since the horror of the fall, a dark, bloody age when the Eldar had paid the price for their complacency and wild indulgences, Eldrad had guided his race through times of great crisis and desperation, but none had come close to the great calamity he felt as a gathering storm at the edge of his vision. A time of chaos was set to descend on the galaxy, as calamitous as the fall, and just as momentous. Yet he could not see it clearly. Yes, his journey along the path of the seer had seen his race saved from danger 100 times and more over the centuries, but his sight had faded in recent days, the gift gone from him as he sought to penetrate the veil that had been drawn over the warp. He had begun to fear that his gift had deserted him, but the song of the ancient seers had called him to the dome, calming his spirit and showing him the true path as they had led him through the forest to this place. Eldrad let his mind float free of his body, feeling the shackles of flesh left behind as he rose higher and faster. He passed through the pulsing wraithbone of the dome and out into the cold darkness of space, though his spirit felt neither warmth nor cold. Stars flashed past him as he travelled the great void of the warp, seeing the echoes of ancient races lost to legend, the seeds of future empires, and the great vigour of the latest race to forge a destiny among the stars. Humanity, they called themselves, though Eldrad knew them as the Monki, a brutal, short-lived race that was spreading across the heavens like a virus. From the cradle of their birth, they had conquered their solar system, and then exploded across the galaxy in a vast crusade that absorbed the lost fragments of their earlier empire and destroyed those that stood in their way without mercy. The sheer bellicosity and hubris of this endeavour astounded Eldrad, and he could already see the seeds of humanity's destruction lodged in their hearts. How such a primitive species could achieve so much and not be driven insane by their sheer insignificance in the grand scheme of the cosmos defied understanding. But they were possessed of such rampant self-belief that their own mortality and insignificance did not penetrate their conscious minds until it was too late. Already, Eldrad had seen the death of their race, the blood-soaked fields of the world named for the end of days, and the final victory of the Dark Saviour. Would their course be altered by the knowledge of their inevitable doom? Of course it would not, for a race such as the Monki would never accept the inevitable and would always seek to change that which could not be changed. He saw the rise of warriors, the treachery of kings, and the great eye opening to release the mighty heroes of legend trapped there to return to their warriors' sides for the final battle. Their future was war and death, blood and horror, yet still they would push ever onwards, convinced of their own superiority and immortality. And yet, perhaps their doom was not inevitable. Despite the bloodshed and despair, there was still hope. The flickering ember of an unwritten future guttered in the darkness, its light surrounded by amorphous, warp-spawned monsters with great yellowed fangs and talons. Eldrad saw that they hoped to extinguish this light by their very presence, and as he looked into the fading dream of the future, he saw what might yet come to pass. He saw a great warrior of regal countenance, a towering giant in sea-green armour, with a great amber eye at the centre of his breastplate. This mighty figure fought through a host of the dead on a sickly planet of decay, his sword cleaving a score of corpses with every blow. Warp light filled the rotted eye sockets of the dead, and the energies of the Lord of Pestilence gave their limbs fierce animation. The calamitous doom of his race hung around this warrior like a shroud. though he knew it not. Eldrad's spirit flew close to the light, trying to discern the identity of the warrior. The warp beasts roared and gnashed their teeth, flailing in idiot blindness at his spirit form. The warp seethed around him, and Eldrad knew that the monstrous gods of the warp would not stand for his presence, as the currents of the warp sought to cast his spirit back to his body. Eldrad fought to hold on to the vision, extending his warp sight as far as he dared. Images flooded his mind. A cavernous throne room, a great godlike figure in gleaming armour of gold and silver, a sterile chamber deep beneath a mountain, and a betrayal of such magnitude that his soul burned with the enormity of it. Cries of anguish echoed all around him, and he fought to hold on to some sense of them as the power of the warp hurled him away from this jealously guarded secret. Words formed from the cries, but few offered any meaning or understanding, their essence burning in his mind with a fierce light. Crusade. Hero. Saviour. Destroyer. But above them all, blazing brighter than all others, Warmaster. From the stillness and darkness came light. A rippling plume of fire, like the tip of a comet, appeared in the darkness of the system's edge, growing steadily bigger as it increased in brightness and intensity. Without warning, the light suddenly expanded with the speed and violence of an explosion, and where once there had been nothing but empty space, there was now a mighty starship, its purple and gold hull still battle-scarred. Glistening streamers of fading energy like fronds of seaweed caught on the hull of an ocean-going vessel trailed behind the pride of the Emperor, and her hull groaned with the suddenness of the translation from warp space to real space. A host of smaller vessels appeared in the wake of the mighty warship, winking into existence with bright flashes and whirls of strangely coloured light flaring around them. Over the course of the next 6 hours, the remainder of the 28th expedition completed the translation to real space and formed up around the pride of the Emperor. One vessel amongst the fleet, the Proud Heart, bore no scars earned at the Battle of the Carolus Star. The vessel was the flagship of Lord Commander Eidolon. It had recently returned from a peacekeeping tour of the Satyr-Lanxus belt, and unexpected war alongside the Warmaster's 63rd expedition on a world known as Murder. The 28th expedition had taken its leave of the Iron Hands following the great victory over the Diasporex with much sadness, for old brotherhoods had been renewed and new ones forged in the crucible of combat in ways that could not be achieved in times of peace. The human prisoners of the Diasporex had been transported to the nearest compliant world and handed over to the Imperial Governor to be employed as slave labour. The aliens had been exterminated and their vessels pounded to destruction by close-range broadsides from the Fist of Iron and the Pride of the Emperor. A detachment of the Mechanicum had remained behind to study what remained of the ancient human technologies of the Diasporex, and Fulgrim had given them leave to rejoin the 28th expedition upon the completion of their researches. Thus, with duty and honour to the 52nd expedition discharged, Fulgrim had led his expedition to a region of space known to Imperial cartography as the Purdus Anomaly, their original objective, following the defeat of the Lair. Little was known of this area of the galaxy. Its reputation amongst starfarers was one of dark legend, for vessels that sailed this region of space were never seen again. Navigators shunned the Purdus region as dangerous currents and freak tides within the Immaterium made it an incredibly hazardous region to traverse, and astropaths spoke of an impenetrable veil that shielded it from their warp sight. All that was known had come from a single surviving probe that had been launched at the outset of the Great Crusade, and which had returned a faint signal that indicated that the local systems of the Purdus region contained many habitable worlds, ripe for compliance. Most other expeditions had chosen not to venture into this ill-fated region. But Fulgrim had long ago declared that no region of space would remain unknown to the forces of the Emperor. That the Perdus anomaly was uncharted was simply another way for the Emperor's children to once again prove their superiority and perfection. The training halls of the First Company echo to the clash of weapons and the grunts of fighting Astartes. The 6-week journey to the Perdus region had allowed Julius time to grieve for Lycaon, and the honoured dead of the First, as well as train a great many of the warriors, elevated from the novitiates and scout auxilia to the status of full Astartes. Though they were yet to be blooded, he had instructed them in the ways of the Emperor's children, passing down his experience and newly awakened sense of pleasure in the fury of combat. Eager to learn from their commander, all the warriors of the First had embraced his new teachings with an enthusiasm that pleased him greatly. The time had also allowed him to reacquaint himself with his reading, and the hours he had not spent with the warriors of his company he had passed in the archive chambers. He had devoured the works of Cornelius Blake, and though he had found much that illuminated him, he was certain that there was yet more still to learn. Stripped to the waist, he stood in one of the training cages with a trio of mechanized fighting armatures, their armed limbs inert as he savoured the anticipation of the coming fight. Without warning, all three machines leapt into life, ball joints and rotating gimbals on their ceiling mounts allowing them a full range of motion around him. A sword blade licked out, and Julius swayed aside, ducking as a spiked ball slashed towards his head and a pistoning spike thrust towards his belly. The nearest armature launched a savage series of clubbing blows, but Julius laughed as he blocked them with his forearms, the pain making him grin as he kicked out behind him and sent the armature that had been coming in to attack spinning back. The third machine sent a hooking blow towards his head. He rolled with the impact as it snapped his head around. He tasted blood and laughed, spitting it at the first machine as it darted in to deliver a killing blow. Its blade slashed out and caught him a glancing blow to his side. He welcomed the pain, stepping in to deliver a thunderous series of hammer blows to the machine. Metal split and the armature was wrenched from its mount on the ceiling. Even as he savoured its destruction, a powerful blow smashed into the side of his head, and he dropped to one knee, feeling the new chemicals in his blood pumping fresh strength into his body in response. He leapt to his feet as a blade scythed towards him and slammed his palm down hard onto the flat of the blade, snapping it from the machine. With the weapon gone, Julius stepped in close and enveloped the machine in a crushing bear hug, hauling it round to face the final armature as it let rip with a volley of iron spikes. All three pierced the body of the armature he held, and it sputtered with sparks as it died. He pushed it aside and rounded on the final machine, feeling more alive than ever before. His body sang with the pleasure of destruction, and even the pain of his wounds was like a tonic flowing in his veins. The machine circled him warily, as though appreciating on some mechanical level that it was on its own. Julius feinted a blow to it with his fist. The armature darted to the side, and Julius delivered a powerful roundhouse kick that crumpled the machine's side and rendered it motionless. He shook his head, dancing back and forth on the balls of his feet as he waited for the machine to restart, but it remained inert, and he realized that he had destroyed it. Suddenly disappointed, he opened the sphere of the training cage and stepped back down into the hall. He had not even broken sweat, and the excitement he'd felt as he'd faced the three machines seemed like a distant memory. Julius closed the training cage, knowing a servitor would already have been dispatched to repair the damaged armatures, and made his way back to his personal arming chamber. Scores of Astartes warriors trained in the halls, either in feats of arms or simple physical exercise to maintain the perfection of their physiques. A strict regime of chemical enhancers and genetic superiority kept an Astartes body in peak physical condition, but many of the new drugs being introduced to the dispensers in Mark IV plate required physical stimulation to begin the reaction in the recipient's metabolism. He opened the door of his arming chamber, the smell of oil and his armor's lapping powder filling his nostrils. The walls were of bare iron, and a simple cot bed ran the length of one wall. His armor hung on a rack next to a small sink, his sword and bolter in a footlocker at the end of the bed. The blood drawn by the training machines had already clotted, and he picked up a towel from a rail beside the sink to wipe it from his body before slumping on the bed and wondering what to do next. A metal frame shelf unit beside his bed held Ignace Carcass's Reflections and Odes, Meditations on the Elegiac Hero, and Fanfare to Unity, books that had until recently filled him with joy whenever he read them. Now they seemed hollow and empty. Beside Carcass's works were three volumes of Cornelius Blake that he had borrowed from Evander Tobias. He reached up to read more of the fallen priest's words. This particular volume was entitled The Book of Urizen, and was the least impenetrable of Blake's books he had read thus far. In addition, it was prefaced by an anonymously written biography of the man, the reading of which greatly illuminated the text that followed. Julius now knew that Cornelius Blake had been many things in his life, an artist, a poet, a thinker, and a soldier, before finally deciding to enter the priesthood. A visionary from childhood, Blake had, it appeared, been afflicted with visions of an ideal world where every dream and desire could be realized, though he struggled to reproduce them in paintings, prose, and hand-colored etchings with poetic text. Blake's younger brother had died while fighting in the many wars that raged in the Nordafrik conclaves, an event the biographer credited with driving him into the priesthood. In later life, Blake attributed his revolutionary techniques of illuminated printing to his long-dead brother, claiming that he had been shown the technique in a dream. Even as a priest, a life Julius suspected he had chosen as a means of refuge, the visions of forbidden desires and his powers as a mystic returned to haunt him. Indeed, it was said that when the high priest of another order first laid eyes upon Blake, the sight of him caused the man to drop dead on the spot. Cloistered in a church within one of the nameless cities of Ursh, Blake became convinced that mankind would profit from his efforts, and bent his will to perfecting the means by which he could best convey his beliefs. Julius had read much of Blake's poetry, and while he was no scholar, even he knew that much of it had no clear plot, rhyme, or meter. What did make sense to Julius was Blake's belief in the futility of denying any desire, no matter how fantastical. One of his chief revelations had been the understanding that the power of sensual experience was necessary for creativity and spiritual progress. No experience was to be denied. No passion was to be restrained. No horror to be turned from. And no vice to remain unexplored. Without such experience, there could be no progression towards perfection. Attraction and repulsion, love and hate, all were necessary to further human existence. From these conflicting energies sprang what the priests of his order called good and evil, words that Blake had quickly realized were meaningless concepts when set beside the promise for advancement that could be achieved by indulging every human desire. Julius chuckled as he read this, knowing that Blake had later been cast from his religious order for practicing his beliefs vigorously in the back streets and bordellos of the city. No vice was beneath him, and no virtue beyond him. Blake believed that the inner world of his visions was of a higher order than that of physical reality, and that mankind should fashion its ideals from that inner world rather than from the crude world of matter. His work spoke over and over of how reason and authority constrained and inhibited mankind's spiritual growth, though Julius suspected that this was a reflection of his feelings towards the ruler of the client state of Ursh, a warrior king named Shang Kahl, who sought to dominate the nations of the earth through brutal oppression. To have openly espoused such philosophies in such a time reeked of madness, but Julius was reluctant to dismiss Blake as a madman. After all, his pronouncements had attracted a great many followers who hailed him as a great mystic, set to usher in a new age of passion and liberty. Julius remembered reading the aphorisms of Pandorus Zheng, a philosopher who had served in the court of one of the autarchs of the Indonesic bloc. He had spoken in support of mystics and how they exaggerated truths that truly existed. By Zheng's definition, the mystic could not exaggerate a truth that was imperfect. He had further defended such men by saying, "To call a man mad because he has seen ghosts and visions denies him his full dignity, since he cannot be neatly categorized into a rational theory of the cosmos." Julius had always enjoyed the works of Zheng and his teaching that the mystic did not bring doubts or riddles, for the doubts and riddles existed already. The mystic was not the man who made mysteries, but the man who destroyed them through his works. The mysteries Blake sought to destroy were those that held mankind back from achieving its full potential and the understanding of the hope for a better future, all of which placed him in opposition to the despairing philosophies of men like Shang Karl and the despot Kalagan, tyrants who preached an inevitable descent into chaos, a terrifying realm that had once been the womb of creation, and which would inevitably be its grave. Blake used beauty as a window to this wondrously imagined future, and from contemporary thinkers he had been drawn to ideas of alchemical symbolism, coming to believe, as the Hermetists did, that mankind was the microcosm of the divine. His reading became voracious, and he became well-versed in the Orphic and Pythagorean tradition. Neoplatonism, the Hermetic, Kabbalistic, and the alchemical writings of scholars such as Erigena, Paracelsus, and Boehmer. Julius knew none of these names, but felt sure that Evander Tobias could help him find their works, should he desire it. Armed with such weighty knowledge, the gigantic framework of Blake's mythology took shape in his greatest poem, The Book of Urizen. This epic work began the narrative of the fall of the heavenly man into the maelstrom of experience, what Blake called the dark valleys of selfhood. Over the course of the book, mankind struggled with the task of transmuting his worldly passions into the purity of what Blake called the eternal. To help this cosmic process along, Blake personified the essence of revolution and renewal in a fiery awakener, a being he named Orc. And Julius laughed at the aptness of the name, wondering if Blake had foreseen the scourge of the greenskin that infested the galaxy. According to the poem, mankind's fall from grace had divided him from his divinity, and through the ages he was forced to struggle to reunite himself with the divine. In the poem, mankind's soul was disintegrated and had to reconcile every element of its being on the road back to the eternal, echoing a myth he had read of the Egyptian tombs. This legend spoke of the dismemberment of an ancient god known as Osiris at the beginning of time, and man's obligation to gather together the dismembered parts in order to arrive once more at spiritual wholeness. In the works of Blake, Julius recognized an original voice in a conventional age unsuited for such libertarian philosophies. Pitted against forces of oppression that could not be swayed by reason, he had resorted to violent imagery and the force of his powers as a mystic. He had become what forces of order do not welcome, a disturbing spiritual force that urged men to awaken their passions in order to change and grow. "Knowledge is merely sense perception," said Julius, smiling as he read aloud from the book. "Indulgence is the wellspring of all things in man, and reason the only curb upon nature. The attainment of ultimate pleasure and the experience of pain are the end and aim of all life."